Welcome to TNT's Hit Songs from Mars, where we unravel the stories behind some of pop's most unlikely hits.
From simple curiosities to songs that changed the world, we examine the socio-political and cultural factors that contributed to the success of these surprising outliers.
And the impact these songs had on society. I'm Tom Thompson.
And I'm Tyler Ralston. And together we're
TNT.
Hey, Tom.
Ty, how's it going?
Good. How are you doing today?
I'm pretty good. What's going on with you?
Not too much. Back to work. Just delivered a rip-roaring lecture on the year 1968.
Did you use the term rip-roaring?
Oh, indeed I did. I'm bringing it back.
Well, you do seem a little bit rip-roaring today, so.
I've got my lapsang souchong in hand. Who could ask for anything more?
Your favorite.
And my last cup, sadly. I'll have to get some more.
Right.
If supply chains allow it.
I'm sort of having a frantic week because I have a gig on Friday where I'm playing in both bands at the same place. At least it's not different places, though.
Or at least challenging. Not at the same time. That would be even more challenging. You'd have to like set them up sort of. You'd be the center of it all, and it could be awesome.
Well, it's funny because it sounds like kind of a hard thing to do, but the funny thing that I like about it is that it's great for me because I can just leave my gear set up. Because usually the most stressful part of playing a show is when you finish playing and you know, I have a pedal steel and guitars and amps, and it's never a large pedal board. So it's nice to be able to just set up and be like, oh, that's it. That's where I am today.
Right on.
So weirdly, it seems like less work to me.
What are the two bands you're playing with?
It's Stillwinter Hills and Graven. And I'm playing in Stillwinter Hills, I play guitar and pedal steel. And in Graven, I play mostly baritone guitar and pedal steel, but mostly pedal steel.
What kind of music?
So Stillwinter Hills is kind of like, I would say the roots are in like 70s rock. It's a pretty loud rock and roll band. Of course, bringing the steel in makes it a little bit country, but I don't, as you know, I don't really play super country, so. And then Graven is kind of like folk rock, but really great anthemic songs, and I love playing baritone. It's really the only band I've played baritone on, and it's such a big. I think I played you a demo.
Yeah, you did. It was awesome.
It's a beautiful sound.
First gig in a while then.
It's been a while, yeah. I've been lucky enough to sneak some in between, you know, when we had little moments of clarity in all this mess. But yeah, it's the first one in a very long time. And then I have a couple more the next week, so it's a little crazy right now.
That's great. That's good crazy.
Yeah.
Well, what do you got on the agenda for today?
Yeah, we can probably dive in. I'm gonna preface it.
Uh-oh, a preface.
It's not a disclaimer.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to tentatively entitle this episode The Power of the Riff.
Okay.
But it's going to confuse you, which makes me kind of happy.
I'm easily confused.
But there's also sort of a tragic element too. So it's like the tragic riff.
The tragically riff. All right.
Very good, very good.
I do my
best.
Very
good Canadian reference. Way to go.
I can't escape my roots.
Okay. Are you ready?
Let her rip.
All right. Here we go.
Okay. Der Kommissar.
Oh, wow. I need it right away.
Just don't turn around. Uh-oh. This is Falco?
Yes.
Okay. I can envision myself in the roller rink, 1983-ish.
Okay. It was released in 81, but it wouldn't have gone anywhere until then. So you knew it right away. That's great. Could you tell right, even just hearing the beat?
And the sound. I mean, the sound is, okay, this is from the early 80s. It was easy. And then, of course, I know the song. That helps.
Do you know any German?
No.
Or, I mean, it's Austrian, but I guess.
Yeah, it'd still be German, yeah. I mean, I know Dudelsack means bagpipes. Stickenstoff means carbon dioxide, and that's about it. That's the extent. Okay. And then, of course, the stuff.
That's very, very interesting phrases that you know.
It's not the words that are important with German. It's how you say it. Just all you got to do is kind of speak like you're being repeatedly punched in the stomach. And you pretty much got it, you know. And then you just have to fill it in with the vocabulary and verbs and stuff like that. So, yeah.
So I have to say that when I was doing research on this song, it was interesting because I kind of had like a hazy idea of what went down, and it turned out it was kind of wrong. But essentially, the song was released in 81, and it did very well in German speaking countries, but not really very well beyond that. Just a clarification point:
was there a simultaneous English translation, or did that come later?
So this is the interesting thing, okay. Because in my mind, I remember, and we'll go through the history a little bit later, but in my mind, I remember being, it would have been probably grade 7, grade 8, something like that. And I remember both versions of the song. And the weird thing is that in my mind, and it's so commonly done these days, Falco did a different version. They released one version and they're like, oh, well, for the English speaking market, we'll record a whole new version. But that's not actually the case.
They just put new vocals on top of the original song.
Not even. So anyway, I'll give you a little bit of the history because it sounds like you had the same feeling that I did about it.
You're right about being confused.
Yeah. So Falco released it in 81 and it did pretty well in Germany. It was funny because it was originally, the song was intended for another artist. It was written by Robert Punger, I don't know. And it was intended for an artist called Reinhold Bilgeri.
Okay.
But that artist passed on it, unfortunately for him, saying it was too soft. So I don't exactly know what Reinhold is all about.
That's a rabbit hole worth going down, it sounds like.
Letztens Nacht, oh honey, träumt mein Herz der Bomberkleid. Es wäre jetzt irgendwo und ich juch gleich aus meinem Bett und ich rief der Psychiater an, weil ich denke, ich bin an einem ganz normalen Mensch, gut sowas nicht in Sinn. Ich bin ganz durcheinander und ich rief ins Telefon. Morgen am Bahnhofsberg, jetzt gibt's eine Explosion. Der Psychiater ist verschrocken, hat kein Wort mehr gesehen. Und bevor ich weiterrede, hat er aufgelegt.
So anyway, he passed on it and then Falco took it up. And so, yeah, like by 82, it was kind of doing well with the German speaking, countries, but it didn't really make any kind of an impact on, the UK or the American charts at all. So then weirdly, a British band called After the Fire, decides to re-record it. And, it's interesting because it's a very faithful version, and which would explain our confusion, because to me it sounds so much like the original that you would think that it was just, you know what I mean? It didn't sound like a cover that another band was playing, and I can actually play it for you here.
So you're actually telling me the song I'm remembering wasn't Falco, but After the Fire.
Exactly.
Far
exactly.
Out.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So anyway, I'll play a little bit of this, and then we'll continue on.
It's not that I don't care, so, 'cause I hear it all the time with
they never let you know on the TV and the radio. She was young, her heart was pure, but every night is bright she got. She said sugar sweet.
So, yeah, so it makes sense that we were confused because it is, it's so close. And so the interesting thing is that I think what happened was in Canada, the After the Fire version came first and it started to do well. And then suddenly, you know, it's interesting at a time before the internet and all that sort of thing, because now obviously if a song comes out, people would dig into it and right away they'd know, oh, the original artist was Falco or whatever. But it's interesting back then that so suddenly what happened was in Canada, the Falco version started to, someone dug up the original version. And so I remember, and it's funny because in Canada, I think the Falco version, I could be wrong about the order here, but I think the Falco version was hit number 11 in our charts and the After Fire version hit number 12. And so they were actually on the charts at the same time.
Interesting. Far out.
And to make things even more interesting, at the same time, Laura Branigan, who you may recall from Gloria, that song, do you know, are you familiar with Laura Branigan? You must be,
well, the one who got her start as one of Leonard Cohen's background vocalists. Eventually.
Oh, really? Yeah. I didn't know that.
Believe it or not.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's interesting. So then the really interesting thing is that she kind of, you know, grabbed onto this. Like, my theory here is that it's a kind of a great riff. It's a very, you know what I mean? It's kind of like a really catchy thing. So she grabbed onto it and was recording her own version of the song, but completely different lyrics, went in a completely different direction, but essentially just used the riff sort of as the basis for the song. And so then the funny thing that happened was, I think she was doing all this thinking that the song had just gone away. Which it essentially had, but then suddenly us wily little Canadians took to this After the Fire version and then the Falco version. And then eventually I think it got onto MTV and then it started to make waves in the US. And then at that point, Laura Branigan was like, oh, crap, you know, I was hoping to release this as a fresh single kind of thing.
And meanwhile, it's the third version.
Exactly. So, and then in fact, what ended up happening was she ended up releasing a different song for the single at that time because she couldn't really see the point of putting it out.
What was the song?
So, it's called Deep in the Dark.
Okay. Good.
I actually have that
catchy
too.
Double entente title.
You ready?
Oh, let's hear it.
Okay. I might skip ahead a little bit because I think it gets
to the riff.
Yeah. Here we go. Very weird beginning. A little slower.
Yeah, she couldn't release that. No way.
It's pretty weak.
The softened
but
version.
Wait till you hear the singing. It's interesting.
She's a great singer.
Was, yeah. If you know where to keep it and you promise not to tell. Have you ever heard this version?
Nope.
Okay. Well, I think it kind of got buried. I think if things
she couldn't release that. The second it got released, everyone's like, she's ripping off Falco, exactly. After the Fire, whoever happened to be. I mean, what I would have done if I were her is reworked the music a bit with a different,
it's a very,
different riff. Because it's an interesting
very
song.
Weird choice to make to just take the riff and then completely rewrite the lyrics. Anyway, I guess that it's just funny that all these different people were grabbing onto that riff.
Obviously a very successful riff, and it brings back, there are a couple other cases where that happened right off the top of my head. Do you remember Chic's Good Times? These are the good times.
Yes. Yep. I wouldn't have known what the band is called, but yes, of course I know that song.
Yeah. Okay. That the bass riff in that was such a sensation that everybody copied it. It was the influence of Another One Bites the Dust. It was an influence for one of the Duran Duran songs that the bass player just like, that's just too cool not to use. A whole bunch of stuff. It was like the bass riff for the next 5 years or some variation on it.
Yeah.
And then again, a totally different set of different time. About 15 years ago, it's getting to be a while, maybe 20. There was a Turkish singer by the name of Tarkan, who did a song called "Kiss Kiss," and it was all sung in Turkish. But it was in the club scene. It was a massive hit for, you know, however long a song in a club scene lasts, you know, half a week or whatever. It's not, you know, pretty low longevity. But it was so catchy, and it had a lot of, it was very Turkish pop, which has a lot of Turkish traditional elements into it. And it was, it just caught on all over the world. But someone else, I can't even remember her name was Stella or something like that, thought she was going to have a mega hit by probably buying the rights to it and then recording her English version. Unbeknownst to her, the Turkish one was going to sweep the charts. Or maybe didn't chart, but it was very popular in, you know, U.S., Canada, and Britain. So her second-rate version just didn't cut it once people went for that original. Let's go!
And that's exactly how I feel about this. I think once you get to the original, it just, I mean, the After Fire version is pretty good. And as we've already pointed out, it's very close, but there is something about that Falco version that's, it's pretty great.
It's a good riff.
Yeah. And of course, you know, he went on to, so what happened? I didn't really finish the story. So then the record company, after seeing all the success of this other version, they re-released the original version. And then, of course, it did quite well elsewhere. And then, of course, it led to a pretty good career for Falco because he went on to do Rock Me Amadeus and Vienna Calling, which were also huge hits. Rock Me Amadeus, I believe, is the only still to this day, the only German-speaking song to top the U.S. charts. Ein Punker unterwegs in der großen Stadt. Es war in Wien, war Vienna, wo alles tat. Hatte Schulden, denn trank, doch ihn liebten alle Frauen. Und jede rief, kann man Rock Me Amadeus.
And of course, I think in the same era, Nina's 99 Luftballons went pretty high, although the English version was just top of the charts. That was one of the biggest hits of the year, 82 or whatever year it came out.
Yeah. I think the original is better, though.
The 99 Luftballons.
Yeah. I do recall at the time thinking this is better. I mean, maybe just because it was, to my mind, it was more authentic or something like that. But I do remember thinking, and it was funny. It was almost the same. It was like the same thing in a way where I think the English version came out and then people dug a little deeper and then got to the German version. And I think it's better.
I kind of remember.
I'll have to listen.
Yeah, I remember, you know, you'd hear the English version all the time. And then once in a while, the radio station would play the German version and people would come, hey, they're playing it. Come listen to the, or, you know, the original.
Yeah.
And it was always sort of a novelty because the other song was such a big hit. But nevertheless, it was, people are well aware of it.
So I mean, one of the things that I'm getting to the tragic part about this song is that the singer from Falco, Johann, I never had know what to do with the umlaut. Is it like ?
Not my language.
Anyway, he died at the age of 40.
I remember apparently. That.
Yeah, and. Laura Branigan died at like 50, I believe.
Yeah.
And the other sort of tragic thing is that when the After the Fire version started to get big, they had basically disbanded.
And so the song is cursed, is what you're saying.
It is cursed. I think it's cursed. I think the riff is cursed. It's a cursed riff.
What are you bringing to our podcast, great things? Tom? What evil spirits are you bringing to our podcast?
So it's funny because, of course, you know, record companies, right? They just see money, dollar bills, and as soon as the song starts to, you know, resurge, I don't even know if that's a word. They try to get the, they just beg with the band to reform, and the band's just not having it. So it would have been interesting if they had reformed too. Like, maybe that could have been a start for them. Maybe not.
Did any of the band members go on to do other projects?
Well, interestingly, I believe that one of the members of After the Fire is the keyboard player from Yes.
Also,
or at some point played in Yes.
Okay, so either a late
before,
member,
I assume.
Yeah. I mean, Yes has come and gone for so many years.
They sure have.
I think too many principals are deceased now that they'll come back again, but
that doesn't stop them, right?
Well, that's true.
it's like, the original tambourine player from the Monkees is alive. Like, let's
let's start a band, man.
Yeah. Another interesting thing is I discovered there's an early appearance of Trent Reznor doing a cover of this song pre Nine Inch Nails on YouTube.
Interesting. A heavier version.
Not really. I don't know if it was just kind of done as a joke or I don't know.
He's going in but different directions at that kind time.
It's kind of fun to. I was never really a big Nine Inch Nails fan, but
me neither.
He's an interesting character. I've heard sort of good things and bad things. He's pretty bad to his bandmates, I've heard. Oh my God, is that libel? Is this podcast libelous?
Yeah, we're going to get sued for everything we got. Fortunately, that's not a whole lot, so we can say whatever we want at this point.
I think it was interesting in digging into the song that weird haziness we had around it that was kind of confusing, those different versions floating around. And I didn't know anything about the Laura Branigan version either, but presumably it was just buried when she realized she'd been beat to the punch by these other, by After the Fire and then Falco bringing it back, you know?
Right. And her music, I like her. I think she was a really good singer, very distinctive voice, good sound and all of that. That's where she got her songs, though, was just sort of picking them up elsewhere. Like, a lot of her hits were these Italian pop songs that she reworked. Okay. Gloria's one of them. And I think that other big hit that she had that was censored because it was so scandalously sexy for the time.
Mm.
You self-control is what they call it. But it's another Italian pop song. So she's just picking up. I mean, it was at pre-internet. That would have been an easy thing to do. Oh, this is a big hit here. No one's ever heard it here. Let me buy the rights.
This is the thing that really bothers me, is when bands, they find these sort of undiscovered songs and they're like, oh, that's a great song. I'm going to release it. And you know, these days, no one would know someone else wrote it because there's no liner notes. In the old days, at least, they would have to say, they'd have to credit the writer. But this is a big beef of mine, is when bands take on a song that's not theirs and then sort of try to make it their own. And an example I'm going to use, there's so much libel coming out here, but do you remember the band Great Big Sea from Canada?
Vaguely.
They're kind of like a, you know, an East Coast party band kind of thing. Good band. I actually met them once when I worked in a music store. They all came in and, you know, started playing all the instruments, and that was kind of fun. But they covered a song by the Oyster Band, and I think, I can't exactly remember what the song is called, But I think that if you asked Great Big Sea fans, even the hardcore ones would have no idea that that song was not written by
them. No kidding.
I mean, it's not really their fault. People just assume, I guess, and it fit their genre. It's actually a great song, and so it kind of. I mean, I guess the good thing is that whenever you cover a song that's written by someone else, at least the original artist will get
the royalties
for that. So they're not going to complain too much. But it just kind of bugs me that the Laura, let's call it the Laura Branigan syndrome, where you kind of.
Oh, there's actually a name for it. Or are you making that up?
No, I'm just
okay.
Kidding.
All right, you've coined a phrase, Tom. This is another groundbreaking podcast. It would have been easy to do. Yeah, there would have been easy to do pre-internet for sure. Maybe a little less now.
I'm trying to think of other examples of bands who've done that. But it's an interesting approach. I do think that the Laura Branigan thing was particularly sneaky, given that she just changed the whole. She just took the kind of the best part of the song and then completely made it her own, but not really like a cover.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious about what...
Pick the bones.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I'm curious. I mean, she would have had to... I don't know. I don't know how the royalties would have worked on something like that. But
probably just offered him a flat fee or something. Hey, can I use the riff?
Yeah. Yeah.
But she got burned on that one, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, she, as we know, she did fine with whatever she was putting out, but it seems an odd song. I don't know her stuff that well, but it does seem like a bit of an odd direction for her to go in.
Yeah, she didn't have a typical pop career in a lot of ways. I mean, of course, yeah, Glory is what she's remembered for.
Yeah.
In that era, a few hits, but you know, maintained her career to the end of her life. But she certainly wasn't in the public eye. Other than that early '80s. But now you got me trying to think of song. Oh, of course, the whole Delta blues and '60s blues stuff. I mean, they've robbed so many licks and outright songs like Led Zeppelin, obviously.
Led Zeppelin, yeah.
I mean, I think
one of the biggest.
I mean, one of the worst offenders, and they acknowledged it. And I think finally it was one of these deals where some of these principals were still alive, they agreed to pay them. Basically, some poor guy living in Mississippi who's, at that point 90 years old. You want $100,000? Yeah, I'll take it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then just
don't. Sad.
Yeah. And then and they get accused endlessly, sometimes legitimately, sometimes not, of ripping off everybody's songs. I mean, the Stairway to Heaven lawsuit, that must have lasted for 15 years. Mm-hmm. The ripping off Spirit. And if you listen to the song, well, here, this treads into some other territory here, but listening to that song, they're similar, but it's a walk down. You know, there's only so many things you do in a song, and if it bears certain similarities.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like there's I don't know when they get into these kind of lawsuits if there's any scientific way that they're doing this, but it strikes me as something that you could almost do scientifically, in the sense that you could be like, okay, is the melody the same? Is the rhythm the same? You know what I mean? And if you had sort of like three out of these five elements that were exactly the same, you'd be like, okay, you ripped that off. I'd be curious to look a little bit into more like how, because I haven't heard anything like that that's super scientific. It seems to be all very airy-fairy how they decide these things, but I could be wrong.
Right. And then, of course, did the original rip someone else off? It raises another question.
Exactly.
There was another case. This was a pretty big one. Well, this poor guy got really kind of screwed a couple of times. Brazilian artist named Jorge Ben, who is one guy's great. The guy's phenomenal. but Rod Stewart flagrantly ripped off Do You Think I'm Sexy from him. Again, with the same premise, like no one outside of Brazil is ever going to hear this, so they're going to think it's mine. And, but it didn't work out that way. And I think what ended up happening was Georges Bain, basically Rod Stewart was forced to acknowledge that he ripped him off, but that was it. No compensation beyond that.
Wow.
And then Georges Bain also got really, this one's almost, you know, don't know whether to laugh or cry. I mean, Georges Bain written down looks like George Ben. And if you were to pronounce it with an English pronunciation, George Benson ended up getting a whole bunch of his money by accident because the names were so similar. And I don't think so he ended up changing his name to Georges Benjor in order for that not to happen again, but he never got his money back. Even though you would think George Benson would have acknowledged the mistake and handed over what was duly his. I don't know, maybe he did. But the
go ahead.
But yeah, the guy had some rough moments in the music industry.
Yeah, it's funny because I know Tom Petty has been involved with some of these where, I love Tom Petty, but I think he at some point it was probably less him and more his record label were suing someone for a song that was similar to one of his songs. But on the flip side of that. I don't know if you've ever. Do you know the band the Jayhawks?
No, I don't.
Heard of them? The Jayhawks and Tom Petty toured together. Jayhawks opened for Tom Petty, obviously. And right after that tour, "Last Dance with Mary Jane," that riff is very similar to a Jayhawks riff. So, I'm not really sure what happened there. I mean. It seems like the people with the more money and power tend to win these things.
The people that win on that's the lawyers.
Yeah.
They get paid either way. I also remember that actually once visiting you in Toronto when you lived there, we were watching Much Music and the Cult had just released Love Removal Machine and the VJs on Much Music were playing it side by side with Start Me Up.
Oh, wow.
And it's the same. I mean, it's painfully close.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's a very different sound.
That's it. The sound's different, but the riff's the same.
Yeah.
And the Cult was just getting furious on air as they were doing this. but come up with a different riff than Start Me Up at the very least. The Cult had their moments, but Love Removal Machine was not one of them.
Yeah. I like that era when they went, they turned so quickly from kind of like psychedelic to like AC/DC style rock and roll.
It was a very conscious decision to get a larger fan base.
Yeah. CBC Radio had a feature for a while that was called Distant Cousins, I think. They did this exact thing. They would pair two songs that they thought sounded similar. And the part that was funny to me was that some of them I didn't think sounded similar at all. And I've heard much better examples of that. But it's interesting the way we all process music a little bit differently. Some people really focus on lyrics, some people really focus on the beat. If you play guitar, you maybe focus a little bit more on the guitar or something like that. So it would kind of explain why people would have these different ideas about songs that sound similar, you know?
Yeah, it's a good point.
It's funny because I remember it's an interesting topic. I mean, for us both being musicians, When we listen to music, we are able to dissect it to a certain extent, right? Like we can say, oh, well, that's a bass guitar, and that's a guitar, that's a pedal steel, that's this, that's that, right? Whereas if you don't play necessarily, you kind of just see it as a whole. And I think both experiences have value. In some ways, I think it is amazing when you the way you perceive it is just kind of like something magical that you don't understand, you know? I kind of miss having that perspective of just listening to something and going, oh, that's just a wonderful song. But then there's another joy when you can kind of dissect it and go, oh, isn't that cool how there's like four guitar parts there and they, you know what I mean? And they added this thing, and it's just an interesting how differently we're all perceiving music all the time.
Yeah, you're making an art versus science case here. You're scientifically dissecting it, but the all the parts greater than the whole is the artwork, you know, as opposed to the individual bass riff or whatever else. When my mind has been, shall I say, altered, it goes straight to the bass and drums every time.
Okay.
Yeah, and as opposed to the...
Well, that would explain the popularity of EDM, like electronic dance music.
Interesting.
Because usually, you know, raves and that sort of thing, where it's all about drum and bass, basically, so...
Yeah, like, just for example, my dad, it's all about the lyrics, and that's all that's important. The music's very secondary, and it's not all that's important. I mean, he writes poetry and things like that, so that's what he's focused in on. And it's a deal breaker if he doesn't dig the lyrics, which probably explains why Leonard Cohen was the only thing he listened to when I was growing up. That was the only thing that was acceptable, barring a few other things here and there.
Now maybe there's a God above. As for me, all I ever learned from love is how to shoot at someone who outdrew you. But it's not a cry that you hear tonight. No, it's not some pilgrim who claims to have seen the light. It's cold and it's a very...
I know a lot of people like that, and I have to say I'm on the polar opposite of that, to the point where a lot of times I find what happens with me is that I'm so overwhelmed emotionally by the music that it's often hard to even hear the words. It's almost just more like sounds to me. The only time it really comes into play if the lyrics are absolutely
horrid.
Terrible. Yeah. And then I simply can't do it. And sometimes sometimes I like a song at first, and then I start to listen more to the lyrics, and I was like, oh, I wish I hadn't done that because they're just terrible.
Well, that's just it though, Tom. I mean, especially in rock, the music versus the lyrics, it's like they're usually not even in the same league. So why wouldn't musicians raise the bar a bit on the lyrics? Mm-hmm. Is it just, you know, obviously no one wants to hear, you know, scat bebop stuff. You do want to hear words usually, but then why not make them good? You know, it's just like the comparison is just, you know, if you listen to the music versus the lyrics, it's like, oh my God, they're just, you know, this doesn't work. This doesn't match.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think often a lot of artists who do up their game throughout their career have a hard time revisiting old hits that were huge hits for them because they are not comfortable with the lyrics anymore.
Yeah, fair enough.
I think that's a huge thing. And
can you think of an example?
I've played with people who. I'll be like, oh, we got to play that song we did, you know, three albums ago or whatever. And they're like, no, I can't do it because of the lyrics. It's usually because of the lyrics. It's not usually about the music. So I guess in some cases people do. And I mean, that's a hard thing. Something that you wrote when you were 18, when you're 50.
Hope I die before I get old.
Well, right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, like the Who singing that lyric now. I mean,
it's laughable.
How silly. Yeah. But it's laughable, but it's, of course, it's perfectly relatable. We change our opinions about everything as we age. We certainly have to. I mean, I've had people call me out for things that I said in the past, and I think it's ludicrous because I'm like, you expect me to think like I did when I was 20? That's such an odd concept to think that you wouldn't have moved forward as a person.
Well, let me tell you a personal story. Something happened to me recently. I was in one of my classes. I was showing a documentary in my drugs in Latin America class. I was showing a documentary, and it was one of the things that came up was Nancy Reagan's "Just Say No" campaign. Okay. I thought Nancy Reagan was attractive. And you know you're getting old when you find Nancy Reagan attractive. It was inconceivable when I was young. But now my range has expanded. It was shocking.
That's
to
so
me.
Interesting.
It was shocking. Yeah. And I, you know, it's like, this can't be happening to me.
That's a great example.
But on the other hand, what you were saying, though, you were, you know, how can I be held accountable for something when I was 20? It's true. On the other hand, how much do people really change is another question. Mm. I mean, we do. Okay, well, and here's an example. There is a former neo-Nazi white Aryan race type duet. It was two young blonde girls. They were about 10 years old, named Lynx and Lamb. And I can't remember what they called their band. But you can look it up on YouTube.
Okay.
And
I'm going to, believe me.
Yeah, and they're absolutely terrible. And but like, you know, Aryan Man Awake was one of the songs, stuff like that.
Wow.
And I mean, it's painful. I mean, it's one of those things. It's you know, do you laugh or cry when you hear it? It was because it's so bad. But now they're adults. And they disavow that entire history. They're saying we were completely brainwashed as kids.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
Yeah, and they identify themselves as like liberal.
Yeah,
you know, whatever that means. But it's so there's a good example of people do change. But
yeah,
it's an interesting question.
Well, they change less as time goes on, I guess. Right? It's like a, you know what I mean? Like the difference, which obviously the difference between, you know, 45 and 50 is a lot less than 15 and 20.
Yeah. Yeah. Now we just become sclerotic and more so as time goes on, you know.
But I mean, it's one of the reasons why I personally have never got a tattoo, because I know myself, like I'm not going to be into that same thing that I was at this time.
Well, if you'd had a jam tattoo, you'd have been all right, probably.
It's true, but I might have had a, you know,
scorpions.
A love at first sting tattoo that I don't think I would be all right with.
Give her inches and feed her well written across your forehead.
Yeah, no, that wouldn't be so good.
Yeah, I'd have like a stegosaurus on my forearm or something like that. No, I would have picked a cooler dinosaur than that. But you know, when I was a little kid,
I feel like we almost steered away from metal in this episode, but again, here we are.
Well, it's inevitable.
Who was the guy? The mascot for Iron Maiden, Eddie. Was his name? Eddie, yeah.
Yeah, I could have easily had if I'd have been tattoo inclined, I could easily have Eddie on my shoulder.
Yeah.
The one on the Killers album. Yeah. Done and done. In fact, I still might.
You know which version you would have.
I still might just go ahead and get that. Yeah. No, and there's an age limit or an age restriction on tattoos, and there's a reason for that.
Absolutely.
And also a tattoo artist I happen to know from my hometown, she will not tattoo people that are drunk.
Oh, good for her.
Yeah. Although that's probably half her business, you know. She's, you know.
I know. I know. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, seeing as this is a music podcast, and actually it's my experience, is that people often point out to me things that I said when I was younger musically that they'll later hold against me, which I think is kind of absurd.
Well, you were so much younger then, or older then.
Yeah, I mean, everyone changes so much. I mean, I think musically I'm still changing probably there's probably no other part of my life that changes more rapidly than my taste for music, I would say.
Well, eventually you'll find your way to the jazz that nobody likes, which is the inevitable end point of all musical development.
I do sort of have a soft spot for some jazz, but it has to be pretty melodic and typically I like it.
Well, you like Bill Frisell.
I do like Bill Frisell. I did get a little tired of his endless digging into Americana. I feel like that played out a little bit early. But
fair enough.
I would say his sound is very influential for me. The way his guitar sound and that sort of thing. And there's a person who you immediately know it's him playing.
That's
you
know true. What I mean? Yeah.
There's people who approximate him. But it's such an identifiable tone. And the interesting thing is it's not equipment. It's nothing like that. In fact, he's known for just showing up in a city and being like, hey, does anyone have a twin reverb amp I can use for the show?
Plug
so
straight
he's not
in.
Worried about tone because he always sounds like himself, which is
interesting.
Pretty neat.
Yeah. Interesting indeed. And there's back to the topic of authenticity. It's like, you know, there's no trickery involved here.
Yeah.
I've certainly moved in that direction. I'm all acoustic. If you can do trickery, without any machinery, I think it's wonderful. I kind of like getting the most out of the instrument without having to use foot pedals and stuff, largely because I just wouldn't be coordinated enough to handle it. So,
well, it's funny that you'd say that because I'm preparing for a show where it's a one person show and I'm going to be doing all that stuff. And I totally agree with you. And it's an interesting thing to try and do. And I think I would always rather be playing with people. But it was an interesting experiment to be like, what kind of ambiance can I create from just myself layering things, And yeah, looping is very difficult and doing it live is extremely difficult.
Take a lot of practice.
Wrong, it's a train wreck. It's really a train wreck. And it's happened to me lots of times where it didn't go well. Luckily, I've never been too afraid of that. I've always liked to improvise, and terrifies some people, but I think it's a huge part of the excitement of live music. And I think a lot of times people assume that it's just jazz where improvisation is happening, but I think generally speaking, it's happening everywhere that doesn't have a pre-recorded track that you're playing to or whatever.
Or you're in a symphony orchestra or something like that. But even there you'd have within the confines of the song or the composition, you could do different things, or the conductor could raise the volume, lower it, do things. So it's there.
It's not much leeway though.
No.
It's not much at all.
Because everyone else is dependent on you doing your part in essence.
Exactly. And which totally makes sense. But it's interesting when you take classical players out of that environment, and say a quartet or something, and they're playing along with a pop song or something like that. I've seen a few cases where at first they have no idea what to do with that freedom.
I believe
they're so unused to it. And once they sort of grab onto it, it's amazing how exciting it is for them to be like, oh, you mean I can just play whatever I want. and in a lot of cases that's when you play a lot of, for lack of a better term, pop musicians, I think a lot of people have it in their head that you go into a studio and everything is laid out for the musicians. And of course that's not the case at all. Some people are like that. I don't find that fun going in and when they're like telling you exactly what to do, I don't understand the point of that, because if they've brought you in as a musician, theoretically they brought you in because of what you bring to songs. So then to then kind of like, round peg in a square hole, like it doesn't, did I get that wrong? It's the opposite.
It could, I think you can go either way on it.
I just don't understand the point of that. So, and it's not fun. And it doesn't get to the best results. Cause if you want it to sound a very specific way, just do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my take on that. And I think people that I play with, appreciate that. And I'll be the first person to say, you know, if someone comes to me and they're like, we want this, this is like a traditional country song, we want a traditional steel part, I'll just be like, I'm not the guy for that. Doesn't matter how much they're paying me. I'm like, there's people that will do that amazingly, and that is not me. So I think, yeah, that's my little rant. It's not really a rant, but
your philosophy.
I think it's just much more interesting when you let people do what their instincts are telling them, because you get to a better place typically than if you have an idea of how everything's supposed to go. And I would argue that for just about anything.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, spontaneity has been your god. So there, you haven't changed much at all, Tom.
That's true. That part hasn't changed. And you know, to go back to this song, and it seems like the common theme here is the riff,
mm-hmm.
right? Like that's the thing that makes it a standout song. And so if you think about that. And I mean, in this case, I guess the song was kind of composed by someone or whatever. But if you think about all the songs where the riff was the thing, those people typically aren't getting songwriting royalty for that. So, which that's, really stinks.
That's a good point.
So, I think, yeah, pay your support player as well. This is such a self-serving podcast.
Shameless, Tom. Shameless.
I know. First the libel and now this.
Right. I'm going to have to hire a lawyer if you keep running your mouth against all these bans, but all right, I'm in. I'm all in.
Maybe because you're in the US and I'm in Canada, we can just keep dodging and be like, no, we're following US law. Oh, no, we're following Canadian law.
Yeah, and then they sue both. Yeah, they sue us in both countries and take us for everything we've got.
Well, that's what we have to look forward to when we're...
Yeah, the trials and tribulations of podcast success.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think I'm going to call that a wrap.
Sounds good. Yeah, good discussion as always.
Thanks for tuning in to TNT's Hit Songs from Mars. We hope you enjoyed yourself and learned a few things along the way.
For a complete list of songs you heard in this episode, visit us at hsfm.buzzsprout.com. We hope you'll support the artists we featured by purchasing their music.
If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and you'll receive new episodes as soon as they become available.
We've been recording all winter and spring and have many more surprising hit songs to share with you.
While you're at it, if you could give us a rating or review wherever you get your podcast, that would really help us out. We would like to thank The Reverb Syndicate for providing the theme song for our podcast. They have an extensive catalog of tunes just as rockin' as the one you hear here.
Here, here.
You can find them at thereverbsyndicate.ca and on Facebook, SoundCloud, and Bandcamp, which typically pays artists the most. We would also like to thank Eric Minot for designing our podcast icon. You can find his design and illustration work on Instagram at Mino Graphics. That's MINOGRAPHX.
You can connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and at hsfm.buzzsprout.com. Feel free to disagree, praise, correct, and chastise us.
We would also love to hear your idea of a hit song from Mars and why you think it fits the mold. Even better, if you felt like recording a voice memo and sending it our way, you can email us at hitsongsfrommars@gmail.com. We may even feature it on the show. Until next time, Earthlings.